everyone, and welcome back. Today's episode of Imagine Publicity on Air is partner sponsored by Wild Blue Press and Imagine Publicity, and we're so glad to have you here listening today. This podcast covers a variety of topics for you who are interested in current events, history, and books. I especially enjoy bringing attention to authors and books that you may not have heard of yet, or maybe it's just popular regionally and needs the bump I can provide through exposing through a national listening audience. I'm the host, Delilah Jones of ImaginePublicity.com, and we're a boutique social media management company that works with individuals, companies, or nonprofits looking for assistance with their social media management. Not only do I offer full services, also I offer training to those who prefer to personally handle their accounts. So I appreciate you being here. I appreciate your tremendous feedback. So please keep the suggestions for future episodes coming. You can shoot me an email at Delilah@ImaginePublicity.com or go through my website contact form at ImaginePublicity.com. Well, today my guest is a fantastic Wild Blue Press author, Alan R. Warren, and he's also the host of the successful House of Mystery radio show, which is heard all over the western and southwestern area of the U.S. I'm hoping to pick up some big hosting tips from him off air. So, but as an author, Alan has written 6 true crime books and several articles published in the True Crime Case Files magazine and Serial Killer magazine. He recently published his second book with Wild Blue Press. He has, I'm not sure how many. We'll get to that. So, Alan, I'm so glad to have you as my guest today.
Well, I'm glad to be here. It's just wonderful to meet you. And wow, this is it. I should be interviewing you. You sound fascinating.
Oh, well, we can do that one day. Well, tell us a little bit about your background. Tell us who you are and what in your background inspired you to become a writer of true crime?
Well, you know, I don't think there's a particular thing I can say that it put me in as a writer. I was always a radio boy. Since I can remember, I would have the old crystal radios in my room and shortwave, and all I did, I had to find radio signals every night. That was my life, was radio, and just loved it, and talk radio mainly. And I really liked the old shows, you know, like The Shadow and, you know, the just, you know, the Scream, the different suspense theater. I just loved that sort of format. And so that it came with me. And when I got into radio, true crime and paranormal and some of these unsolved mysteries, that's why we called it House of Mystery, was kind of what we wanted to cover. That's what I wanted. And so true crime was a big part of it and has been for 7-8 years, the true crime section. And so it's just flourished. And actually, and how it happened was just there was a few papers and magazines that started asking me if I would write a little thing for them about some guest that I had on or some story I had about guests. And that's how the writing started, and people liked it, and it got more and more. And so R.J. Parker, publisher, approached me, and I did a four-book deal, and they were the short reads in true crime. And so I did those, and they did well. And so then they reapproached me, and then I did I redid 2 of those because they've sold so well that they wanted to do a full, whole version of it. And then along came Wild Blue Press and Steve Jackson. And that happened by, you know, happened. It's just, it was luck. You know, you meet these people on your interviews and stuff. And I had a story, Last Man Standing, And that was really about what we're going to talk about today. And I sent it to him. I sent him some of the idea and some of the writing. And he said, go for it. So I did. And here we are.
Well, that's great. It's interesting how radio translates into writing, because I don't know about you, but I try really hard not to do scripted shows. That I like more of a conversation, but I can see how, you know, I've listened to a lot of podcasts and radio shows where it's a storytelling thing, and how, whether it be a true crime or whether it be a story of other things, paranormal or whatever, I think it's really coming into its own now. And that's kind of exciting for all of us. So how do you choose which cases to write about?
You know, for me, it's about it's about how it ends. Let me explain this theory. You know, when you're a journalist, you're on the air and you're doing journalism for TV and even radio, and you're doing reporting. You're reporting the facts. You're reporting the event, and the feelings are supposed to be kept out of it. The most important thing are the facts. So when you get the step over, when you write into a book or an article, is you, for me, it becomes something of advocacy. I'm actually advocating for something. I'm wanting something to change. There's something that happened that's wrong in this story, and I want to see it change. I want to at least let people know this is going on. So I'm advocating for something, and that puts my feeling into it. And that's the difference between what a journalist would do for that story and what I would do. I'm taking something on. So every one of these books that I've written, there's 9 now in all, and every single one of them has something that happened during the trial or after the trial. Something happened, and it was just it just blew my mind away. And I thought, well, people don't know this stuff. They're not going to hear this on the news. They're not going to really know this. And this is something that makes it really important. So it's a little bit different of an angle than a lot of other true crime writers.
I can definitely see that. And I think making a murder kind of opened a door for this way of thinking, that not everything is the way it seems in a true crime case. And I had the pleasure of working with a private investigation firm for a while, and they were amongst the early people who arrived, I guess what you might say, in the world of wrongful convictions. And they were able to exonerate a man who had been in prison for 25 years. And it really opened my eyes. And then I also worked with Diane Fanning, who wrote the book Through the Window, which actually led to the truth being told in a case where a mother was convicted of killing her son, when actually it was serial killer Tommy Lee Sells. And she was able to uncover that. Yes,
yeah.
And she won the Innocence Project Award. I mean, so, you know, this is something that I picked up in The Last Man Standing, which I'd love for us to go into. Through my own experience working with these people, it's kind of, like you say, it's sort of become a cause that people don't really think about or know about. And I think it's important, and obviously you do too. So in The Last Man Standing, you have one murder, 2 investigations, and a wrongful conviction. So why don't you kind of give us a background on this case, and let's talk about that.
Well, the case, the general timeline was in December of 1957. Two little girls, Maria Riddle and her friend, decided to go out and play. It was the first snowfall. It was the first snow of the season, early December 1957. They lived in a small little rural town. It's called Sycamore. About an hour outside of Chicago, 5,000 people lived there at the time, so not a big town. And so they raced home, had their dinner, and ran out and started playing in the snow. Somewhere between 6:30 and 7, a gentleman approached them, and he said his name was Johnny, and he wanted to know if they would like some piggyback rides in the snow. And so they're all excited and giggly, and so the guy gave Maria a piggyback ride up and down the road, and then asked Kathy, that's the other girl, and she said no, but she said, here, let me go get my doll. She went in to get her doll, she come back, and the other two were gone. So then she went back home, nobody saw him. She went back to her friend Maria's house. And eventually it all became a big, okay, she's missing, she's lost. And police got involved, and all sorts of things were going on. You know, the town was in a fury. They couldn't figure out what was going on. And but eventually, down the road, they did find the body. It was actually in the next year, in the spring, and the case actually went cold. They had bits and pieces, but no good evidence, no solid evidence, and the case went cold. Now, Jack McCullough was a neighbor boy, 17. He was kind of a smart aleck kid. He got himself into a lot of trouble. He would get into fights. He would get into fights with his teacher. He would be drunk. He would steal things. You know, he was that kind of kid. That's who he was. But what he did was he joined the army and he left the city. And then he went to Vietnam for a couple of tours. And then he went to, became part of the fire department. He became part of the Air Force. He actually became a captain in the Air Force and finished out all of his duty. Came back to the States, moved to Washington State area, and he became a cop and got married and was living his life there. And the case was cold the whole time. Nothing new came up, and there was nothing going on in the case. So where the problem was is Jack's mother was really sick with cancer, and she eventually died. And he never got to see her. But apparently the two sisters said that on her deathbed, the mother had told both of them that those two little girls, Jack did it. Jack did it. You got to know, Jack did it. And then she died. So she made this deathbed confession saying that her son was the one that tried to kidnap them both, got the one, and killed her. So the sisters took that to police, and finally the Illinois State Police finally took it as a case. And they did their investigation, and then they eventually charged him with the kidnap and murder of Maria Ridloff.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about Jack McCullough. I understand that he ended up changing his name. What precipitated him to do that? Why did he change his name?
You know, it was one of the weird things I thought when I was breezing through the case. And what I realized was he was born in England, and it was during the war. And his mother used to hide him up in the fields under boats and in different places. It was like they were being bombed all the time, and they were in the north end, and it was really rough on them. And her husband, Jack's father, got killed in a battle. So there was just the two of them. And she worked as a nurse in a local town, fixing up wounded warriors and stuff. And she met one who was an American. That was the Mr. Tessier. And she fell in love and married him. And so he took her back home to Sycamore, Chicago, and of course took Jack along. as his stepson. And so Jack's name then was Jack Tessier. And so as time went on, he and his mother died, he wanted to honor his mother and his father. So he went back to his original name is what he really did. So it's not, it's that. He's just gone back to
okay,
his
there's
name.
Nothing nefarious or anything. Okay.
No, I mean, some people try to look at it and they're trying to twist it like it is, but I'll tell you, all it really was, you know, he didn't like his stepfather. They were not close. Hate was probably the closest word to their relationship. You know, he wanted nothing to do with him. And his real father he loved, and he remembered him as a loving father. And his mother was an angel. He thought she was just the best in the, you know, one of those. So he wanted to honor them. So he went back to his original names from them. And this happened before any of this weird crime stuff. So I believe him. And after talking to him, I really do believe him. He had no interest in trying to cover things up and all this. He was doing this before the crimes were even happening. So,
but didn't he have kind of a contentious relationship with his stepsisters, weren't they? Or half-sister?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very complex case. And what happened was he's the oldest of them. The rest are all step because they're from the new father. And he had a separation of them. He didn't feel love from his father. He didn't feel support from his stepfather. He felt very isolated. He was older than the others. The others were girls. He was a boy. You know, the three in the middle. So he felt, I don't think he felt as part of the family in that way. He seemed to continue his relationship with his mother, and that was going really well, but not with the sisters. Completely fighting and there was just all these silly little things that happened. And there was nothing major that happened that you would have gone, oh my, you know, there's something wrong. Not for the first little while. The family got along quite well.
So as things progressed in this case and the deathbed confession, and I understand it was the sisters who pursued this investigation into him, and one of them accused him of rape, correct?
Yeah. Yeah. When they brought this back to the Illinois State Police, the deathbed confession, they interviewed all of the girls, all of the family again. And in that interview, the second to the oldest sister said that she had been abused, that their father, Tessier, or Jack's stepfather, would come in and sexually abuse the two oldest girls every night. And the oldest girl would decide who it was going to be. If she wasn't in the mood, she would send him to one of the younger girls. So this had been going on, apparently, for years. And the mother did nothing. This is the story we get from the sisters. Now, that middle sister said that when she was 13, 14, Jack, who had just bought a new car then, 17, and a convertible, offered to take her for a ride. So she said, sure. She got in the car, and he took her to friend's place. And in her claim is that they all gang raped her several times for several hours. There was, I believe, four of them. And then he took her back home, and then they had dinner. Now, I laugh, and I don't want people to say, oh, what an ass. You know, you laugh at something like this. I laugh because it just sounds silly. first of all, you've got a relationship where they don't speak. They don't speak for a year at a time. And then the girl's getting molested every night from the father, and she hates her brother, won't talk to him. And he comes along and says, "You want to go for a ride in my car?" Doesn't sound very realistic. And then she goes, and then she gets raped several times for several hours, and then brought back home, and then they all had dinner together. Remember 1957 in a small town of the U.S. Families ate together. You had the mother that didn't work because she stayed home and took care of the house. She did the laundry. She cooked the meals. She served dinner at 5 o'clock. All the kids were there, make sure they wash their hands, clear the table, clean. That was a very, very popular part of our culture in the 50s and 60s. Even in the 70s, my parents made us do that. I don't know about you.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, if you weren't there at 5 o'clock, you had hell to pay if you weren't sitting at the table by 5. So I understand. Yeah. Just to kind of put this into context as far as, you know, like a time frame, it was 1997 that the case was closed but not solved. And then the mother, this deathbed confession, this didn't come until 2008. So, you know, we're looking at a lot of years in between, number one, the happening of this crime in 1957 to where they closed it in 1997. And then basically, you know, the sisters start pursuing this investigation in 2008. So a lot of time has gone by, and you know, it sounds like, obviously, the sisters carried a lot of burden of their assault and everything that was happening in their childhood as far as, you know, being molested. So I just wonder how much of that they projected onto him. Is that even possible?
Oh, totally. I think it all went on because whatever side you fall on, just looking at it from outside, no feelings, just looking at it legally. If he was actually raping her as well as the father was, and all this was going on, yeah, there'd be a terrible amount of animosity, hate, frustration, because nothing's getting done about it. There'd be a lot of anger. And so I believe that is the anger that drew the two girls, that actually put them in give them the fire to do this, because it actually took them 6 years from when they had the deathbed confession to actually get to a court. And this was a long going battle for them, because there was other problems. You know, the sister that had been raped, for instance, had charged 5 other men for doing the same thing. And
and for the way I understand it is that they finally charged him and went to trial in 2012. Didn't they charge him with the murder and the rape at the same time? You know, the raping sister, or was it two different cases?
Clayshaw, state attorney at the time, didn't have enough evidence for the little girl, Maria Riddle. So he thought what he would do is charge her or charge him for raping his sister and get him convicted, and then take him from that position to charge for the Maria Riddle, and he'd get a better result. So they first charged Jack with assault and rape, and some battery charges and some kidnap charges, as in holding her against her will at the house for hours and stuff. So he got charged with all that first, and that got acquitted. So he was let go and given his free pass, so to speak. You didn't do it,
right?
You're free. And
he was
then
acquitted.
They brought in, yeah, and then they brought in the kidnap, murder, and possible sexual assault of 8-year-old Maria Rudolph from 1957.
Okay.
So that's
basically
that.
There wasn't enough evidence in the sexual assault to make it stick, obviously. So he was acquitted of that. Then he went on trial for the murder. And I have to mention here, this man is 73 years old now.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
So, you know, well, we all know there's no statute of limitations on murder, and that's a good thing. So now this Jack is 73 years old, and he's going through a murder trial. Tell us a little bit how this all came about.
Well, they charged him with murder, arrested him, and set up the trial date. And they had nothing but circumstantial evidence. They
well,
had
this
no
was based
detail.
On the deathbed confession of the mother?
That was it. That was it. And in fact, what made it even worse was the two sisters that reported the deathbed confession give two different accounts of what she had actually said and how she said it. So they're not even consistent in what the deathbed confession was. So that was a really weak piece of evidence. And the other evidence was like I was talking about earlier, was that they knew the girls had, and Maria had been picked up between 6:30 and 7 p.m. that night. She went missing. So, and the problem was that Jack, that particular night, was over an hour away at the intake center to join the Army. He wanted to join the Army, so he was going through his physicals, his reviews, his tests, and doing that. And in fact, at 6:57 p.m., he called his mother, Collect, back in Sycamore, to ask her to come get him and give her a ride, or give him a ride, because he didn't want to take the bus back home. And, you know, it was snowing and all this stuff. And so that was 6:57. We know the girls, it was between 6:30 and 7. So how can he be in two places in one time?
So what kind of evidence, what did they use to get a conviction?
So what they did was, they actually didn't, so they tried to get that phone call and the evidence of the timing thrown out of court. They didn't get it done. So what they did was they went back and they changed the time. You see, how it works.
Oh, so you've opened another Pandora's box of prosecutorial misconduct.
Oh yeah, this was minimum misconduct. This was, I think it was planned. They actually went by, because get this, okay? Remember, there's the two girls out playing in the snow. Johnny comes up. You want a ride? Sure. Gives him one a ride, comes back. The other girl goes, oh, I got a doll I've got to show you. Runs into her house. And then when she's in her house, she gets a brand new doll. And her mother's like, where are you going with that? I'm going to take it outside in the snow. And then, of course, the mother's like, you are not taking that. Take something else. That's for your brand new doll. And so she goes, okay. And the mother leaves the room and she takes the brand new doll. And the father looked and all this, and he didn't really get too involved because his favorite Western show was on and he was watching it. Okay. And so she runs and then she goes out and the others are missing and it all begins. But his favorite show was on between 6 and 7 p.m. This is the time when we only had two TV channels. There was no stop and go and recording and video, VH and DVD and all this stuff. So we know for a fact that the father's a witness that she came in between 6 and 7 to get her doll. And then we know he called at that time and the girls were missing. So all the time, so they didn't call the father in to testify for the time. And because they got that other evidence in with the phone call, they decided to change the time back to 5 to 6.
Oh, wow. So the father was still alive at that time?
At that time he was. Uh-huh. At that time
okay.
He was.
Wow.
So they intentionally didn't use the evidence of the father. They didn't, or even of the mother, when the girl came to get the doll. They didn't use the evidence of anything, like they of the phone call. They didn't want to use that evidence. They just they changed the timing so that it could happen. They made it fit so Jack could have done it.
Mm.
Right. So whatever you want, you know, without putting a word on that, is that misconduct? Is that something that we think is okay as law enforcement? You know, in their mind, the cops had to think either, yeah, he did it and we're going to make sure he gets put away. You know, they had that in their mind and they thought they were doing the right thing and let's just get him away.
I think this is an issue in our justice system today, is the fact that prosecutors don't even want to take a case unless it's a slam dunk and they can win. It's all about the win. The evidence and justice seems to be secondary to winning a case. And this happens so much. It's just, you know, another one of my pet peeves I could go on forever about, but I won't do that today. That's another show.
And do you want me to really give you a twist to make it even hurt more? We know this. Well, now we know. Okay, so the two cops and the state attorney that changed the times on the evidence, and we know that they did this, so they changed those timings. Nothing can happen to them. There's a 3-year statute of limitation on police officer misconduct like that. In Illinois. So nothing can ever happen to them for doing it.
Right. All right. Another issue. No accountability.
Yeah. So you could, you know, they really had nothing to lose. They can do that. See, it puts you in the situation where, yeah, let's just do it and get this done with and everything can move on and quiet down the town. And even if they find out like they did years later, there's nothing anybody can do about it. You're almost asking them to do it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So he was convicted at 73 and given a life sentence for this.
Yes.
So
yes, he was.
Okay. After he went to prison, what happened next? What did he do through his appeal? His right to appeal.
Well, he applied for a few different in a few different directions. One about, of course, the biggest thing in the case that we haven't talked about was when they were the girl was missing and all the cops were there. We had the FBI, Illinois State Police, and we had Sycamore City Police. They're all there doing the investigation. The FBI file. Once they found the body was still in the state line, they closed up and moved on. So that was closed and moved, and you're down to the city and state police. Well, in the trial, in the 2000s trial, when Jack first was being charged, he introduced the FBI file. Case file of the case of the time, and wanted it to be brought in as evidence. And so they had to have a recess. And of course, the judge and the prosecutor got to read them over, and the judge had to make the decision. And he decided that it would not be allowed in as evidence because it's hearsay. So, the problem with that is the FBI had given him a polygraph, which he passed. They had also ruled him out because they knew about the phone call and the timing of the pickup and all that stuff. They also had two other suspects. In fact, one guy's name was John, and they interviewed this John guy, and he was there at the night, and he even admitted to talking to the two girls between 6:30 and 7. He said that he had lost directions, or he lost his way, and he wanted directions somewhere, so he stopped because he saw the two little girls playing, and he asked them for directions. That was between 6:30 and 7. And so, and to go even further on that man 5 months later committed the same crime to a 5-year-old and was caught and was convicted and put in prison for life, where he died. So all of that was closed up and not allowed to be brought into trial, so the jury would not hear any of that.
Well, and this brings you to the other side of this whole issue of wrongful conviction, is when you put the wrong person in prison, the one who actually did it is still out there committing other crimes. And
exactly.
So it definitely has a huge ripple effect in our communities, not just in the judicial system, but all through our communities. When you have multiple crimes being committed by someone who someone else is serving time for them.
Yeah, it's devastating, because you look at the system, it's not set up to help. It's just set up as a business, and it's a large business, and there's no great organization there. Everything just sort of goes and this is a perfect situation and a perfect reason to be angry. And his biggest appeal was to get that FBI file back into a trial, because that would prove his innocence. In his mind, that would make all the difference. If the jury knew that evidence, there is no way they would convict him. And to be honest, I think he's probably right.
What were his post-conviction efforts? Was he represented? Was an attorney there to take the case and help him through this?
Yeah, he went through this a few times, and he was going through this. But that's not actually what really worked for him. He was going through the challenges and the process, but that never worked for him. There was a state attorney in Illinois that decided to go through the case. He went through the complete case. And at the end of it, wrote a report saying that Jack McCulloch was wrongly convicted and should have never been convicted on the scattering of what they call evidence in this case. And so what he did was he approached the court and asked for them to stay and overturn the conviction, because it was. Just there was no evidence. It was wrongly, just the whole thing. So that blew up all over the news then, because when do you ever have a state attorney actually turning around and saying, no, this case was tried wrong. This guy was convicted and put away, and he didn't do it. And the evidence was terrible. So that's really what got it going and got it changed. And it took him a matter of 6 months to get a judge to agree with him and to let him out of jail.
Well, and so he was actually in prison for several years, right?
Yes.
This wasn't just in and out kind of thing, and he's out. No.
No.
So the case was dismissed and he was actually declared innocent, which I understand a lot of times that doesn't happen when you have a case that's been exonerated. You have to go through hoops to have that declaration of innocence come down for you. So where's Jack today?
Well, Jack went back to the Seattle area, in the northern part of Seattle, outside of the city, near the water, near the beach, where he loved it. I know he said to me that when he the very first time that he came into that area, in the Edmonds area, north on the beach, he knew that's where he wanted to live. So when he came back from his services with the Air Force, that's where he went. And same thing with the prison. Now, I have to say, there's a couple of things on that we can add on this. One is, when he went to prison, he was a ex-cop, and he was known as a child rapist killer. So he had a terrible stay. That was not an easy time in prison. And I've included a lot of the stories and a lot of the things that happened to him. You know, he got stabbed in his ear the very first day. He got stabbed in his eye. The people were out to kill him. They all want to kill an ex-cop and a child assaulter. Just how it is. And he was neither. I mean, he was an ex-cop, but he wasn't, you know. So he had a really rough time in prison. And when he got out, his wife was still there waiting for him. And he still is with her, though she's on sick bed a lot. She's sick a lot. And in fact, some of the times I was visiting and we were spending time, he would just take the bus into Harborview Hospital and spend time with her because she was on life support. And, you know, and it's so hard, you know, you spend this time with someone and this whole thing came along because, Casey Porter, his stepson, his daughter's husband, and that they heard me do an interview with Charles Lockman, who wrote that awful book that made that terrible Lifetime movie about Jack McCulloch. And they turned him into like Jack the Ripper. And I didn't give him a good interview. I didn't like him. I didn't like how he was. They heard me, and that's how they got in contact with me. And then it started from there. And this family has been through hell. And yeah, it was complex, and there was a lot of weird things. A lot of families have this sort of stuff going on. And Jack said to me that he would let me write the book as long as there was no dirt, just tell the truth. And which I respected almost completely. I had to bring the reason I had to bring in on the sister. I know that he wanted to protect his sister and keep this all out of it. But the problem was so much of what the sister did and how much she was involved made it so that, you know, I had to include him, or, you know, the sister and the guy and all that. So that went on. And so, yeah, now he's back at home and he's just kind of living the low life, trying. And the families are all suing, of course, for all the different things. Wrongful and present for all the years and all the other things that they, but for him, he's not concerned with it. His biggest concern, and even with the book, is he wanted people to come out of it knowing that this can happen to you. This can happen to me. This can happen to anybody in the United States of America. This is the way the system is, and this is what we all have to live with. And none of us should feel that this couldn't happen to us, because it does.
Absolutely. And that's a very powerful message to get out there, is the fact that yes, it can happen, and it does happen every day. And in the meantime, no one's been charged with the murder of this child, correct?
Correct. And, you know, and for the fact of the matter, the person that they charged in the year after, the following year in 58, for murdering and raping a 5-year-old who was the same Johnny that talked to them within the same half hour that they were attacked, I think in everyone's mind in law enforcement, that's who did it. I just think that's just what it was him. And anybody I talked to, anybody I was around, it's just an unknown fact. It's just one of those, what's the point of go after who? He did it.
Yeah.
So I put him in there and I put his scenario and his name. And I also listed a couple of other suspects that came up, but this was pretty obvious. It's one of those you can't go back, you know.
No, and unfortunately, you know, the whole dysfunction of the family and the sisters and all that happened to them, projecting on onto this case, and basically, you know, almost ruining a life and more than one. So, yeah, there's a lot of twists and turns in this case. Now, let's just briefly, since we're getting on to that other end of the clock here, you have a couple other books I wanted, and what I would love to do, if you would graciously accept my offer, is to have you come back so we can go a little deeper into the other books that you have so many good ones, but one I think specifically is The Killing Game, about the Rodney Alcala case, and then the other is Beyond Suspicion. So all of the, I mean, you've got some pretty intense cases that you've written about and researched, I'm sure. So maybe you can sort of give us an overview here and what listeners can expect on our next interview.
Well, actually, The Killing Game was a little self-published book I did a couple years back and just put it out. And none of the publishers wanted it. And, you know, that happens. And after it was out for a month, Oxygen Network contacted me and said, we would love to make a documentary out of this. And so I said, okay. And so we did. I went to L.A. and we did all the filming. It comes out in December here, Mark of a Killer on Oxygen, if you have it. And if not, you'll see it on an NBC station somewhere, I'm sure, and it's based on the book. And this is the story of Rodney Alcala, and he was the winner of the game show, and he was very charming. He was very smart. He, you know, when he graduated with his marks, he actually ended up getting accepted in NYU to study under Roman Polanski in film school.
Oh, that's an interesting. I didn't know that.
Yeah, this man was not, he was not what you would expect in a serial killer. Now, there's something even more evil about this. This is amazing because when he was home in L.A. doing and working and doing things, he's the guy that would dress up like a photographer and go to the beach and say, hey, I can take some pictures of you. You can win a contest, and that old thing, and and offer them and get their phone numbers or their address. Some of them would even
really,
go home.
I really try to warn our daughters about don't go with that guy.
Yeah, it's just if they're real, they'll have no problem contacting your parents, you know. But anyway, he would even get them to go home. And he would take pictures of them, and he would get them naked, and then he would do all sorts of bad things, which we can talk about in the future. So he was going around doing that. Now, at the same time, in America, there were several other murders going on. And he was actually going around to different cities, and he would find that victim, and he would kill them, and kill them in the same way of the mass murderer, so that they would be thrown under that crime, not him.
Oh, wow. So he was stuck in under the radar.
He was smart. He was devious. He went to and that's just, we were just talking about this on the show last week, because now he keeps getting DNA hits all over. Like there was two in Nevada, there was three in Houston, there's like five in Seattle now, there's two in New York. So in New York, the 64 caliber killer, he would copy. So he would pick the same age group of a person, a girl or whatever, and the same hairstyle and the whole works, and kill her the same way. The Hillside Strangler, two of his victims were on the Hillside Strangler list, not until later when DNA came out. There was one in Salt Lake City now that popped up. And it's just actually now that some in Florida are popping up, and that was the latest news because they were males. So he was thought of.
Well, I remember seeing, and I don't remember if it was on the news or on social media, they were passing around the, you know, this whole collection of photos to see if, you know, if anyone would recognize some of these people in these photos so that they would know whether that person was safe, missing, or a victim. So he had thousands and thousands of photos, right?
Yeah. Yeah. When they raided his locker in Seattle, they had, they actually had over 3,000, and the FBI and New York Police Department both put up a page for Rodney Akella with pictures, and they put just over 300 pictures on each site, and they just wanted an identification of any of them. And the majority of them were girls, but there were some boys. And in fact, that's what it was. One of the killings from another case has come up, and it was in Rodney Akella's pictures. So they found the victim in his pictures, but they considered him to be to have been killed by one of these gay killing groups or guys. And now it's looked like it won't. And so they're going to test for DNA. And I think we're going to find that. We're going to find he's going to outdo Bundy. This man is going to get well over 100 victims before they're through.
And he, you know, hopefully way behind bars somewhere.
You know, this is the angle. This is why I took it. It was not because of all these things. That just was, blew me away. I couldn't believe. But he's been convicted three times for four different death penalties, 12 different times. He's in California. When you're convicted of death penalty in California, you get an automatic appeal. And the automatic appeal goes up to the Supreme Court of California. The Supreme Court of California right now does not accept death penalty. So 65 of the last 73 that they've had to deal with, they've overturned. So, and he's one of them. So he get, like the last one, he got convicted on five murder counts, five death penalties. He gets the automatic appeals, and every one of them gets overturned. So they have to just do it all over again.
Oh, good grief.
It's crazy.
What is wrong with that system? My God. I mean,
it's,
I can't even imagine.
I talked to some of the people that were important, like in the commissioner's office and all that, and they said, listen, the judges are anti-death penalty. That's it. It's not going to change. So there's no point in doing these because this is going to keep on happening, and it's going to keep them in jail, and it'll keep them in jail for life. And then you've got some new prosecutor that wants to bring them to death because they've got the pressure of the families. Now, to top it off, the worst thing is he acts as his own lawyer. He goes in with his sports jacket, sunglasses, and his hair done, and he gets to ask all the victims' families. He gets to cross-examine all of them.
Ugh.
And so they have to actually live this same thing over. We're talking cases all the way back to 1978. These people have not moved on from the case because they've already been to court three, four times, sometimes more, and they're going to keep on going. And they'll never have any – I don't like to use the word resolution, but what it is it's not over. Like, you know, when the case is closed, done, you're put to death, whatever, it's over, and then you go through your periods of grief and anger and all that, and then you start developing new relationships, new life, and you move on. It might not be great, or it might be, you might need counseling, whatever. But you can't even get into that spot until it's over because you keep on facing this creep in prison. And you know how long these trials go. They're not just a week. And then you've got all the cameras in there, and it's just a big circle, and it doesn't end. And it costs all of...
The people are victimized over and over and over and over again, and this is this is so wrong. It's just so
wrong
on many levels.
I can't wait to have you back
and we can dig into this one even deeper.
Oh,
and you know,
that one's just you're just
yeah.
It's
deeply disturbing, and I think, you know, again, the more information about it than we can get out, it's not so much that we want to relive this person's crime or talk about his crime, but the more information we can get out to the public about this type of person that could be your neighbor, the more aware maybe people will be so that we can prevent these kind of people from walking on earth. So tell me, Alan, what projects have you got in the fire? What does the future look like for Alan Warren?
Well, and I just released the Beyond Suspicion, which is the Russell Williams, the colonel that flew around the Queen, and he was raping and killing girls and hiding them in his basement at the same time.
You sure know how to pick them.
Well, I tell you, they're very unique,
yeah,
but they're very good, and there's a lot more to it. And remember, people, I do not write just for the gore, and I do get negative comments for that because I write the facts as it is, but I do it in a polite way. We're talking about victims. I'm not going to sit there and gore over it and get into all this. I want people to understand the facts, how they were found, the problems, and the, you know, the things. But there's more to this case than that, and that's how I write. So, and that's about it. Next year, my new project will be Blood on His Hands, and it was about the police officer that killed the 16-year-old autistic boy on the streets of Portland when he was trying to remove him from the downtown.
Oh, yes. I think I remember that.
Yeah, Anne Bremner was the lawyer, and she won $40 million for autism and some other stuff, and the cops lost. And she's helping me. Actually, I'm writing it for her in her casing because she's doing the Amanda Knox case, right? So.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, so that's kind of like my next one of my projects for sure. I tend to have three or four.
Oh,
I always
good.
Got things. Yeah, I've always got three or four going, and just whatever happens.
That's a good way to look at it. Well, I really thank you so much for coming on today and talking about the case of Jack McCullough and in the book The Last Man Standing. And tell listeners, where can they buy your books? That's important.
Well, the books are sold everywhere. Like Wild Blue gets it out to quite a few bookstores. And we're also in, you know, Kindle and Kobo and all of that stuff, Barnes & Noble. It's pretty much everywhere. And if you need information or more on it, just go to somethingweirdmedia.com. And
I'm assuming that's your website.
Yeah, that's and
something
that,
weird
you,
media. I like that.
Yeah, well, because it's something weird. And we have the because there's five hosts that work there, and we all three of us write books, so all of our books are there. Special deals as well, or if you want something signed, let us know. All the shows are there, the schedules and the guests that we have.
And don't forget to tune in to House of Mystery Radio Show, which I'm assuming you can pick that up on iTunes and other podcast directories.
Yeah, yeah, and it's all on there. If you go to the website, it says where to listen. It lists all the, you know, it's on all the main, you know, Podomatic and, you know, all of them.
Yeah, so all the information, find it at somethingweirdmedia.com. Well, everyone, thanks so much for being with Alan Warren and I today. And remember to stay safe out there. And more important and most important to me is be kind to each other.